Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Puerto Rican independence activist Jorge Farinacci, who talks about the circumstances surrounding the death of nationalist leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios, killed by the FBI September 23rd. Tom Wilner, an attorney representing 11 detainees at the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base, who discusses the month-long hunger strike undertaken by at least 128 prisoners there. And we hear some of the diverse voices raised in protest against the Iraq War during 3 days of actions in Washington, D.C., September 24th through the 26th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of Afghanistan's parliamentary election, President Hamid Karzai called for a halt to a U.S.-led bombing campaign. He also demanded an end to foreign troops conducting house searches without the permission of the Afghan government. As Karzai told reporters, "I don't think there is a big need for military activity in Afghanistan anymore. The nature of the war on terrorism in Afghanistan has now changed." The call for a radical change in military tactics comes nearly 4 years after the ouster of the Taliban regime by U.S.-led forces. The BBC reports that the Taliban carried out a post-election raid of a police station and jail in the eastern Afghan city of Khosht, blew up an arms cache there, and fled across the border to Pakistan. Over the last 6 months, 1,200 people have been killed in Afghanistan as U.S. troops increased efforts to flush out insurgents. Earlier in May, Karzai sought control of the 20,000-strong coalition force, but President George Bush insisted the troops remain under U.S. command. Human rights groups have accused the American military of engaging in torture at the Bagram Air Base. In July, over 1,000 Afghans protested outside the U.S. base, seeking an end to arbitrary house raids and arrests. Peru's former spy chief, Vladimiro Montesinos, is on trial in Lima for directing a death squad that killed 15 people in the early 1990s. The intelligence chief of former president, Alberto Fujimori, was arrested in a corruption probe and remains in jail on charges of bribing an opposition politician. Prosecutors charged the death squad, Grupo Colina, run by Montesinos, with gunning down 15 people, including a child, as part of a massive crackdown on the Maoist-inspired Shining Path rebels. The paramilitary group also kidnapped and later killed 9 university students and a college professor. Fujimori, who is in exile in his native Japan, is being sought by Peruvian authorities to stand trial for condoning the death squad. But the Japanese government has refused to extradite the former president. Yet Fujimori has promised to return to Peru, which he ruled from 1990 to 2000, to participate in the 2006 presidential election. Early election polls show Fujimori getting 20% support among voters, 3 times the popularity of the current president, Alejandro Toledo. Laura Sens, a relative of a death squad victim, told Reuters, "God may come late, but he doesn't forget. We demand punishment. What more can we ask?" The Federal Election Commission has filed a lawsuit against the right-leaning Club for Growth for violating spending limits in the 2004 political campaign. In the first case involving a 527 independent committee, FEC Vice Chairman Michael Toner, a Republican, explained, "At stake is whether the Club for Growth will be able to continue to raise and spend millions of dollars in soft money for activities influencing federal elections. The FEC will also require the Club for Growth to file as a political committee and comply with the McCain-Feingold law, which banned soft money." The action was the result of a complaint filed by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee over ads run by the Club for Growth attacking former Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle, who in 2004 lost his re-election bid to social conservative John Thune. Last year, the Bush re-election campaign and campaign finance groups sued the FEC for failing to enforce the soft money ban. Those cases are still pending in federal court. According to the FEC suit, the Club for Growth raised more than $4 million over the federal limit to help elect or defeat a specific candidate. Most of the funds were raised from 14 donors. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Longtime Puerto Rican nationalist leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios has been killed by the FBI. On the FBI's most wanted list, U.S. authorities labeled Ojeda Rios a terrorist and sought his arrest since 1990 when he cut off his electronic ankle bracelet while awaiting trial for his involvement in the 1983 $7 million Wells Fargo truck heist in West Hartford, Connecticut. When the FBI discovered where Ojeda Rios was hiding with his wife, Elma Beatriz Rosado, in the mountains of Hormigueros, Puerto Rico, they began a 3-day stakeout. Then on Friday, September 23rd, at about 3 p.m., the FBI claimed 72-year-old Ojeda Rios suddenly opened the door of the farmhouse and began firing at them, injuring one of the agents in the stomach. They said they returned fire. According to an autopsy, Ojeda Rios bled to death after being hit by a single bullet. His wife was also detained, but later released. No one was allowed to enter the house until Saturday, almost a full day after Ojeda Rios was shot. According to Puerto Rican activists, the FBI has 125 arrest warrants on others allegedly connected to Los Macheteros, the pro-independence organization also known as the Boricua Popular Army and co-founded by Filiberto Ojeda Rios. It appears that the September 23rd raid was no coincidence but deliberate on the part of the FBI, since that date commemorates the 1868 uprising against Spain and thus is the most sacred day to supporters of the Puerto Rican independence movement. Jorge Farinacci is an attorney and former co-defendant with Ojeda Rios in the Brinks trial. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about the impact the nationalist leader's death may have on the Puerto Rican independence movement.
This is a sad day for not only for our movement, it's a sad day for our country. The pride of the Puerto Rican people has been shown as tens of thousands of people came into this town of Naguabo to say goodbye to the fallen comrade, to the fallen comandante, Filiberto Ojeda. The indignation expressed today and the ratification of the desire to keep on the struggles really is now upstaging the sadness that the people have felt after he was murdered last Friday by the FBI.
Can you give a little bit of history as to actually what the story was? I guess this is a testimony by his wife in a press conference after the shooting.
After she spoke and after the neighbor spoke, is that more than 100 FBI agents surrounded his house. A gunfire started immediately. They started shooting without any kind of calls or kind of opportunity for Filiberto to do anything. After several exchange of gunfires, he told the agents that somebody was going to come out of the house, and after they acknowledged that, his wife left the house. She was then taken, the FBI's put in the floor, blindfolded, and handcuffed in the back. And after that, the shooting continued. She's saying that as soon as she was blindfolded, she knew that they were going to murder him. And that's exactly what happens. Also, an autopsy was done to the body, which confirms her story that he was alive for 3 or 4 hours. And the FBI refused to give him any kind of help or take him to the hospital. He had been hit, but he could have been safe if he had been taken and taken to the hospital because he was alive for at least 3 hours after the shooting.
Where was he shot exactly?
He was shot in the upper arm. In a very small way, it touched one of his lungs. But it was not a life-threatening gunshot, but he bleeded out.
Right. It became life-threatening with lack of medical attention, and therefore he bled to death as a result.
That is correct. That's what happened. Also, after he was dead, the FBI tied his feet with a cord, with an nylon cord, and dragged him all around the house on the patio. When he was confronted by the press why they did that, they say they do it to see if the body had any kind of explosive on it. They also killed the little dog of his wife also. What they did there was something horrendous.
Are you saying they killed the dog? Is that what you're saying?
That is correct, yes. A small female dog they had.
The significance of September 23rd is, it's not a coincidence that the FBI went into this day.
No, that's not a coincidence. As many Puerto Ricans in the States know, the 23rd of September is the most important day for independence movement. It says that we commemorate the first uprising of Puerto Ricans against colonial oppression in 1868. From now, it's going to be even more important because it's the day that the FBI, through their assassins, murdered our compañero, one of the most important leaders of the movement in our country.
Given the fact that Filiberto was one of the, as you say, one of the most important leaders of the independence movement and co-founder of Los Macheteros, what happens now? What happens to the movement now with his loss?
The pride of the Puerto Rican people has shown up, and we have to be very vigilant because they want to destroy our movement. And if we don't take the steps to avoid that, they just might try hard to do it. So this is an open question right now, what's going to happen.
What about the response of the governor, Vila, of Puerto Rico?
Well, it's been a very pathetic. It has been sad. It has been colonial. They have been very submissive toward the U.S. government, although they are very aware of the indignation of the people, and now they're having a little bit of rhetoric against the way that the FBI conducted the operative.
Any final thoughts, Jorge Farinacci?
For many years, the United States government has been trying to destroy the movement. They gave our movement a big blow last Friday, but it is obvious from the response of our people it was going to be impossible to defeat the desire for freedom that the Puerto Ricans have had for so many years, and that desire has been crushed by the United States. But the people keep on coming and coming and coming, fighting for freedom, so we will win. We will win at the end. There's no doubt about it.
That was Jorge Farinacci, an attorney speaking from Puerto Rico on the FBI killing of Filiberto Ojeda Rios. For more information, call Pro Libertad at area code 718-601-4751 or visit the website www.filibertoojeda.com. Photos depicting the mistreatment and humiliation of Iraqi prisoners held in the U.S.-run Abu Ghraib prison erupted into an international scandal when first published in the spring of 2004. Now, in the last of a series of trials conducted against nine low-level soldiers accused of prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib, Army Private First Class Lindy England has been convicted of maltreating detainees, committing an indecent act, and conspiracy. The 21-year-old, now awaiting sentencing, faces up to 9 years in prison. New allegations of torture at U.S.-run detention centers in Iraq and Afghanistan have surfaced in a report issued by Human Rights Watch based on the accounts of two soldiers and an officer with the 82nd Airborne Division. The report describes widespread abuse and asserts that low-ranking soldiers have been held responsible for acts that officers condoned. Attorney Tom Wilner represents 11 Kuwaitis held in detention at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He filed suit on their behalf in May 2002, saying they had a right to challenge their detention in court. In June of last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in their favor, but the Bush administration has interpreted the ruling so narrowly that it has effectively negated the detainees' rights. Wilner argued some specifics of the case again on September 8th, and a ruling is pending before the U.S. Court of Appeals. In protest of their indefinite imprisonment without charge or the prospect of a trial, at least 128, or nearly one quarter of all detainees at Guantanamo, have undertaken a hunger strike. Press reports state that 18 prisoners have been force-fed in a hospital since the strike began August 8th. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Wilner about the legal odyssey of his clients and the significance of the hunger strike.
It's important to understand that the government took these people to Guantanamo Bay so it could argue that it was beyond the law, so that the courts could not look at what they were doing. That was their explicit purpose for doing it. They argued that because these are foreigners and because they're being held outside the United States, that they have no legal rights and no access to the U.S. courts. So although we won before the Supreme Court, you know, almost 15 months ago, the U.S. government is stonewalled and not done anything and has said we have no legal rights. They're making the same arguments again.
There was a fairly widespread hunger strike in June and July, and that ended after the government made some promises to improve the treatment of the prisoners who were on hunger strike. But now more than 100 prisoners are on hunger strike again. Can you explain what's going on?
I just got back from Guantanamo Bay visiting my people. We found out that five of them are on the hunger strike. Two of them are being force-fed by the government. I expect by the end of the week it'll be four or five that will be force-fed. You've got to understand that these people have been in captivity now for about 4 years. It's an open secret in Washington that many of the people at Guantanamo are absolutely innocent. The commandant down there has said that most of these people don't belong here. The deputy commandant has said that. And a lot of interrogators have said publicly that most of the people down there had no connection with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Yet they've never had any sort of fair hearing at all to determine that. So these guys basically claim, first of all, look, we're innocent. If they think we're guilty in any way, let them charge us so we could defend ourselves. And that was their basic demand back in July for the hunger strike. They also said, and treat us in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. Most of these people are kept in isolation. They're allowed exercise only an hour a week, sometimes in the dead of the night. You know, so they just have none of the basic accommodations of people, even convicted killers in prisons here. So they said, change the conditions. Apparently, the government down there, or the military, said, look, we can't do anything about, trying you or charging you. That's up to Washington, but we can improve the conditions. And for a few days in the end of July, this is what they told me, the conditions were improved. They also tell me that some of the interrogators down there were apparently not happy with this. And it happened that a few of the people, including one of my clients, was abused in an interrogation, sort of sexually humiliated in an interrogation. When he refused to go to interrogation, then they had an emergency team, what they call it, come in, and he was beaten up. And that started the hunger strike again. And now I just got back from it, and it's a terrible thing. These people are not doing it as some sort of publicity stunt. As one guy told me, he said, look, I have been here for 4 years. I'm an innocent person. If they want to charge me, that's fine, but otherwise I should be released, and I'm just not going to eat anymore at Guantanamo. He also said that they have read some of these stories of congressional people who go down there and say that Guantanamo is a wonderful place, like a Caribbean resort, and they're eating good food. And he looked at me and said, I'm just not going to be part of this lie anymore. If I eat, I condone my treatment. I'm not going to eat down here. And if I die, it's better than being in this hell.
But, of course, the government isn't allowing them to die. It's force-feeding those who are the weakest.
You know, I don't want to go out and advocate that my people should die. I want to advocate that they should have the basic rights of American justice to be, tried or charged so they can defend themselves. That's really what I think is basic. I can't tell you how tough it is to see these people on hunger strike. They look like pictures from the Sudan. You know, they're skin and bones. They've just been denied the basic principles of American justice.
Tom Wilner, do you think there needs to be a major outcry from the U.S. public in order to get justice for these people? Or do you think your legal maneuvers might succeed on their own?
When we brought the court case, we knew that it would take a long time. And we hoped that it would be one element of added pressure on the administration to do the right thing, to stop reacting out of fear and giving up our principles, but to try to do the right thing, to just give these people the right to a fair hearing, which is all they've ever asked for. You know, and let me just say that I, and I think everyone else on my side, believes that the United States needs to do whatever it needs to protect its security. You need to be able to detain bad and dangerous people. But the essence of the rule of law is you need to have a fair procedure to make sure that you're detaining the right people and not the wrong people. You need to have a procedure to distinguish them, and we've never had that here. I'm terribly disappointed at the U.S. government, but I'm very, very disappointed at U.S. citizens in general and, frankly, at the media, because this is an outrage. It's just totally contrary to everything that this country is supposed to believe in and which is stood for around the world. And there should be an outcry. Every time we go out to cocktail parties and have fun and laugh and dance, we should know that our country is maintaining a prison that is just horrible, that it's not better than concentration camps. And that's just wrong. We should be outraged about it.
That was Tom Wilner, an attorney representing 11 detainees at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. For more information, contact the Center for Constitutional Rights at area code 212-614-6464 or visit the group's website at www.ccr-ny.org.
No more cluster bombs, we shall not be moved. No more cluster bombs, we shall not be moved. And silently, we're standing by the water. We shall not be moved.
In the largest protest in Washington, D.C. since the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, an estimated 300,000 opponents of the war came to the Capitol to demand the withdrawal of American troops. Through rallies, marches, lobbying, and nonviolent civil disobedience, protesters expressed their anti-war sentiment, now widely shared by a majority of the American people. Between the Lines, Scott Harris was there and files this report.
The night before, tens of thousands of protesters streamed into Washington for the weekend's largest demonstration. Opponents of the Iraq War held a candlelight vigil in front of Walter Reed Army Hospital, where many soldiers injured in the conflict are being treated. The 100-plus activists and veterans gathered in front of the military hospital, a facility soon to be closed by the Pentagon, had two main purposes for being there: advocating the best care for returning soldiers and a quick end to the war. While dozens of counter-demonstrators shouted insults at the vigilers from across the street, Elliot Adams, a Vietnam veteran from New York State, explained why he had come to Walter Reed Hospital.
Well, I know that when I was a soldier hitting from my wounds, I would have been damn good and glad to see people out there. War is very costly for people. I'm sure you're aware, for example, and I like this statistic because I think it gives a perspective, more of my compatriots have committed suicide since they came back from Vietnam than died in Vietnam. That tells you what the price is. You can't fix a PTSD, you can't fix the DU, you can't fix the uranium, you can't fix the Agent Orange. But the one thing you can do is don't make any more. And that's what we need to do.
The next morning, Saturday, September 24th, saw more than 100,000 people from all over the country converge on the Ellipse directly behind the White House. At a rally there, many speakers pointed out the connections they saw between the Bush administration's disastrous response to Hurricane Katrina and the mismanagement of the Iraq War. Longtime civil rights and social justice activist Jesse Jackson.
America, the whole world is watching. National security begins in New Orleans. New Orleans security at home. Emergency preparedness was not prepared for the emergency. The Gulf states in America is a metaphor for Gulf states in Iraq. The Gulf states policy at home and abroad has failed. We must go another way.
Cindy Sheehan, who galvanized the peace movement with her August vigil in front of President Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch, demanding a meeting with the president, was greeted enthusiastically by the crowd.
My good friends in the media aren't doing their jobs. Most of our friends in Congress aren't doing their jobs. George Bush certainly isn't doing his job. But so you know what? We have to do our jobs as Americans.
After the rally, protesters flooded the streets to march past the White House. Karen Treach traveled to Washington from Denver, Colorado.
I was in Crawford, Texas. I went to Crawford for 4 days to stand with Cindy Sheehan when she was holding vigil there. And I wasn't planning to come to D.C., but everyone that spoke there as they were leaving stage, they were like, we'll see you all in Washington on the 24th. And so when I got home, when I got back to Colorado, I bought my tickets, and here I am.
What do you hope will come out of this weekend?
What I hope is, I hope the administration begins to realize that the majority of Americans are against this war now, and even if they don't change course, the people converging here and coming together, just knowing that we're not alone, we're not sitting in our living rooms taking it anymore, and we're connecting and we're growing stronger and we're going to bring it down.
Many activists viewed the protest as an important civic duty. David Bernard came from Kodiak, Alaska.
What motivated you to take such a long trip to Washington?
My disgust with what my government's doing.
And what do you hope will come out of this weekend with your presence here and so many others?
Just bring awareness to the country that there are people who are opposed to what's going on and they need to join us.
In the evening, thousands of protesters settled in near the Washington Monument for the Operation Ceasefire concert, featuring a diverse bill of anti-war artists such as Joan Baez, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Jello Biafra, and The Coup. Steve Earle, whose music crosses the traditional boundaries of country, commented on the role of artists during a time of national crisis.
What's the role of an artist, a poet, people in the arts generally? What's their role, you think, in this time, in this country, with the multiple crises we're facing?
Hold up a mirror. You know, to hold up. You can say things in a song that are, when you wrap music around stuff, it doesn't hurt quite as bad. I don't know why, but it's true. And you can impart information to people that you wouldn't be able to reach otherwise. And I write songs so I can look at myself and figure out why I do things and figure out how to do them differently if I need to.
The day after the rally in March, Leslie Kagan, national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, one of two coalitions sponsoring the events, assessed the effectiveness of the anti-war actions.
Well, I think it's the weekend is going fabulously well. Yesterday was a tremendous turnout, and it was one of those, the kind of challenges that organizers love to have is that how do we even begin to count the numbers of people here? People were all over the streets of Washington, D.C. Our estimate is that it was well over 300,000 people, and other people give much higher figures. So the point is that people came from all over the country, from communities big and small, from all walks of life, and said, you know, not only is this war having to end, but we're not going away until it does end. And people, the energy that people had here and out on the streets was just phenomenal. Old people, young people, you know, and a lot of families. I mean, it was really a very, very dynamic and determined group of people that walked the streets of Washington directly in front of the White House, and it was clear that the problem is the White House and the problem is the Congress. And people came to Washington wanting to deliver messages to both the Congress and the White House.
On Monday, September 26th, hundreds of activists swarmed Capitol Hill to lobby their congressional representatives, while some 370 others, including Cindy Sheehan, chose to be arrested in front of the White House in an act of nonviolent civil disobedience. While activists will be debating the significance of the numbers of protesters who came to Washington for this series of actions, it was clear that momentum is solidly on the side of those organizing to end the war in Iraq, an opinion shared by a growing number of Americans. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Peace. Now.
You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.